there really is a system in Portland, and the main way to interface with it is to go to your local neighborhood association.
Oh, that's a good
and
point.
They have land use chairs, and of course there are lots of rules and lots of places you can go and learn more about it by going to the Planning Bureau and reading the documents and going to meetings and stuff. But that's the interface to start getting involved in the land use development system.
I really appreciate that, and you're absolutely right. And that is something that can be tedious, but it's very important. Those meetings of the neighborhood associations frequently develop a certain level of power and influence, which can control behavior by the city council and others than the bureau people. So I really want to thank you all for this show. We run out of time. I want to urge you all to stay tuned to KBOO. Remember, we fight for you, we fight for the right, and we give you the best music at the same time.
To sing songs, it will prove to you that this is your world, and that if it has hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that will make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Movin' On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot
This is Mary Graham. My husband Donnie Graham, after being down 20 years in prison, was shot and killed by the Clackamas County Sheriff. My four beautiful daughters were taken by the state. I turned to drugs to ease the pain. Listen to my story of healing and hope on Prison Pipeline.
That's Prison Pipeline, June 30th at 6:30 p.m.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:03 a.m. Coming up this morning on at One Land, Many Voices, we hear speakers Phyllis Bennis and Josh Rubner speaking on Seeds of Justice and Hope for Palestinians and Israelis. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary, followed by Flashpoints, and at 11, the Radio Zine. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not yet a KBOO member, you can remedy that when you go to kboo.fm and click where it says Donate Today. So, One Land, Many Voices features speakers recorded at the Friends of Sabil conference that was held in Portland on April 4th. The theme of the conference was Seeds of Justice and Hope for Palestinians and Israelis. What is required of us? We'll hear two speakers from a panel on the state of the Mideast peace process, Josh Rubner and Phyllis Bennis. The program begins with moderator Steve Niva, who teaches international politics and Middle East studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington.
The topic, as you can see, is the current status of peace talks. I don't know if you're like me, but you may have got a sense of deja vu when you saw that title. And these days, probably a strong sense of vertigo. If you're like me or any of the panelists, you've probably been to a talk called The Current Status of the Peace Talks, the peace process for the last 30 years. I've probably been to this talk many times. If by peace process, We are thinking about a process which has virtually guaranteed the non-existence of a Palestinian state and the continuation of Israeli settlements, then I think you'd have to say the peace process for the last 30 years has been a success. But this July, we were told that by the effervescent John Kerry and President Obama that there was going to be one final shot at the peace process. As John Kerry told us in July, he said, the window on a two-state solution will be running out within a year or a year and a half. And by next April, this month that we're in right now, we should reach a final status agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians. Well, as you can see, it's April, and the peace process, it continues, but it is feeling, I think, like us, a strong sense of vertigo. So what's new about this current peace process? Where are we? How should we think about this? How should we analyze this? That's going to be the job of our wonderful presenters today. Our next speaker is Josh Rubner. He is the National Advocacy Director of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. He's a former analyst in Middle East Affairs at the Congressional Research Service, and he's the author of the recently published Shattered Hopes, Obama's Failure to Broker Palestinian-Israeli Peace. It's a story ongoing, and maybe he'll give us a glimpse of his new last chapter. Here's Josh Rubner.
I've been traveling around the country on this book tour, and people have been asking me, aren't you being a little bit premature and presumptuous by declaring that President Obama's policy to broker Israeli-Palestinian peace has been a failure, given that he still has more than 2 years in office? But as of really last night, it gives me no great pleasure to say that once again, the United States has proven itself to be fundamentally incapable of brokering an Israeli-Palestinian accord. Speaking in Morocco yesterday, Secretary of State John Kerry called for a reevaluation of whether it made sense for the United States to try to continue its efforts to broker Israeli-Palestinian peace through this nine-month process that he's been leading. And he fell back on this familiar U.S. trope, which was the exact same trope that Obama and his administration engaged in the first time around of, we cannot want peace more than the Israelis and Palestinians, which is an incredibly problematic approach to take for U.S. foreign policy, because what it does is it really exculpates us from our responsibility and complicity in Israel's apartheid regime that it maintains over the Palestinian people. And it ignores the fact that were it not for the massive amounts of weapons and military aid that we provide to Israel, if it weren't for the diplomatic protection at the UN, which affords Israel with impunity for violating international law, if it weren't for this U.S. support, we probably wouldn't have the continuation of this issue to begin with. So it's very problematic for Kerry just to wash his hands of the situation and to say, well, we tried our best, but we can't want peace more than Israelis and Palestinians. So it falls to me today to do a sort of post-mortem of this latest U.S. effort to broker Israeli-Palestinian peace. And what I'd like to give you is four reasons why I think that this process is on the verge of collapse, or maybe it's collapsed already. I haven't checked the news yet today. But it's clear that this end of April deadline for achieving an agreement is not feasible. It's not feasible even to achieve a framework agreement. And in fact, John Kerry, 2 days ago when he was in Algeria, confirmed that Israeli and Palestinian negotiators weren't even talking at all about substance. They were only talking about process. So after 21 years of negotiations, they're still at the process phase and still not talking substance. So why have these talks failed or are about to fail? Let me give you four reasons. And in many respects, this effort that the Obama administration has been very intensively engaged in this second term has been even a more fundamentally wrong and incoherent approach than during its first term, when it had a grand total of 3 weeks of negotiations. Because just because you have John Kerry racking up significant frequent flyer miles in his more than dozen shuttle diplomacy trips to the Middle East doesn't mean that there's been any quality behind the quantity of these negotiations. And in fact, it's not even clear that Israeli and Palestinian negotiators have actually met to talk about substance since last fall. That's how much of a standstill these negotiations have been at for the last several months. And here's why. During Obama's first term, at least at the outset of his administration, the United States made an effort to at least appear that we were interested in halting Israel's illegal colonization of Palestinian land. This today, in President Obama's second term, is not even the case. We've dropped the pretense that we even care about halting Israel's colonization of Palestinian land. And in fact, since these negotiations recommenced in July of last year, Israel has announced the expansion or the permitting of more than 10,000 additional settlement units on Palestinian land in the West Bank in East Jerusalem. Now, at the start of this process, a reporter asked Secretary of State John Kerry the very logical question after Israel had announced yet again that it was expanding these illegal settlements. And the reporter asked John Kerry, he was speaking somewhere in Latin America, do you expect that Israel will continue to announce the expansion of these settlements while the parties are sitting down and theoretically negotiating a Palestinian state on these very lands that Israel is colonizing? And John Kerry said something to the effect of, yes, we understand that there are many Israeli settlement projects that are currently in the pipeline, and we anticipate that Israel is going to continue to announce the expansion of these settlements during the course of these negotiations. But, he said, we don't want that to be an obstacle to the success of these negotiations. So this is the degree of insanity that really characterizes this U.S. approach to this issue. I mean, I have, and I've had in my mind, this mental image for a long time of President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry sitting around and trying to hammer the square peg into the round hole. It doesn't fit. It's not a matter of how hard you hit it or how many times you try to hit it in. It's the wrong pattern. It doesn't fit. This whole, quote, peace process, I think, brings to mind Einstein's definition of insanity, which is to do the same thing over and over again and expect that somehow you're going to get a different result. So in the first term, at least you had the pretense that we cared about halting Israeli colonization. In the second term, it's pretty much out and outright collusion between the United States and Israel in the continuation of this colonization. That's reason number one why this round of talks has failed or will fail in the very near future. Number two, we need to take a look at who the United States is appointing to be a so-called honest broker in the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. Again, in Obama's second term, you actually have a worsening of the policy as compared to his first term. Because in his first term, he appointed somebody to be his special envoy for Middle East peace who actually stood a decent chance of functioning as an honest broker. And that person was the former Senate Majority Leader, George Mitchell. This was the same person who brokered an end to 8 centuries of sectarian fighting between Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland through the Good Friday Accords of 1998. This was a person who brought to the table significant and very real and tried approaches to resolving a very complex historical religious conflict successfully. George Mitchell knew what he was doing. And in fact, he broke from this mold of having a clear pro-Israel ideologue as the person who we place in charge of these so-called peace process talks. But in his second term, Obama has reverted to this pattern of appointing people like Aaron David Miller, who admitted that his role as a negotiator was not to be an honest broker, but to act as Israel's lawyers in these talks. Or someone like Dennis Ross, who wrote in his memoir, A Missing Piece, that his job was to, quote, sell Israeli ideas to the Arabs and to get the Arabs to scale back their expectations. He actually wrote this in a book. He actually admitted the structural biases of this US policy. And so what Obama has done in his second term is he has gone back to this tradition of appointing pro-Israel ideologues to his, quote, peace process team. The person who is leading these talks on behalf of the United States is a fellow by the name of Martin Indyk, who, before he worked for the US government, get this, before he worked for the US government, he was a senior employee of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the largest, most important component of the Israel lobby. This is like pointing a fox to look out over the hen house. Who's his deputy? A guy by the name of David Makovsky, who comes to us via the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which is a think tank in Washington, which was set up by AIPAC. David Makovsky's, quote, expertise is that he issued a policy paper on the notion of territorial swaps between Israel and a to-be-formed state of Palestine, in which I'm sure Israel gets to annex the choicest of West Bank lands in exchange for Palestine getting some barren and uninhabitable sand dunes attached to the Gaza Strip, as was the proposal in the Camp David negotiations during the Clinton years. So this is the second reason why these talks have failed or will fail in the near future, is because we have clear pro-Israel ideologues leading the US, quote, peace process team. The third reason is a newfangled Israeli demand that Palestinians recognize Israel as a, quote, Jewish state. This has been a major bone in the throat of these negotiations, standing a chance of succeeding. Now, what is this demand all about? In fact, it's something that has no precedent under international law or in diplomatic history, because the way recognition works is that states recognize other states by exchanging ambassadors with them, by voting for them to join the United Nations. There is absolutely no obligation for one entity to recognize any special characteristics of another state. There's no obligation for Canada, when recognizing the United States, to recognize us as a state which has a majority of its citizens who are white. There is no precedent like this under international law. And in fact, as Zaha mentioned, the PLO recognized the existence of the State of Israel in 1993 when this whole sham process began. So what is this new demand that Israel be recognized as a, quote, Jewish state all about? First of all, it was put forward deliberately, I believe, as a non-starter by Israel, to put forward a demand that they knew that the Palestinians could never accept, in the hopes that the Palestinians would walk away from the table and yet again be blamed for failing to accept an agreement that would only perpetuate rather than alleviate and end their oppression. Benjamin Netanyahu is a smart guy. Make no mistake about it. In my book, I document how he outfoxed Obama on a number of occasions, and this is clearly what he was trying to do as well with this demand to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. So why was the Palestinian negotiating team so vehemently opposed to the idea of accepting and recognizing Israel as a Jewish state? Well, what this demand means in practice is getting Palestinians to recognize and acknowledge and accede to Israel's discriminatory practices towards its own Palestinian citizens. It's a demand that Palestinians recognize Israel not as a state of all of its citizens, but as a state which gives special privileges and benefits to its Israeli Jewish citizens as opposed to its non-Jewish Palestinian citizens. This is what Israel was asking the Palestinians to do, to accede to their own discrimination. Furthermore, what this demand of Jewish state was all about was a demand by Palestinians to recognize the irreversibility of Israel's ethnic cleansing of 1948 and accede to a supposed right that Israel has to continue to artificially maintain a situation in which it demographically engineers its citizenry to maintain a majority of people who are Jewish. Israel is today a state that has a majority of its citizens who are Jewish for one reason only, which was because 90% of the indigenous Palestinians who lived in what became Israel were ethnically cleansed from it in 1948 and denied their right of return in accordance with international law. Now, this is why it was a non-starter, because refugee rights do not belong to collectivities. Refugee rights do not belong to nations. Refugee rights belong to the individual refugee. Only an individual refugee can determine for him or herself whether they want to go back to their home, whether they want to stay where they are, or whether they want to get resettled in a third country. No government has the right or the ability to sign away rights on behalf of individual refugees. So what Israel was asking the Palestinians to do by making permanent this act of ethnic cleansing in 1948 was to deny or attempt to get the PA or the PLO to deny the rights of these refugees to return, a position which the PLO could not accede to even if it chose to and even if this was written on paper. Now, some people say, well, maybe the Palestinians might have gotten a state out of these negotiations. And this, I think, is what is so confusing to the casual observer of this situation, is because everybody says that they are on the same page when it comes to the outcome of what these negotiations are. So the US says that it wants a two-state resolution. Israel says that it's committed to a two-state solution. And of course, the Palestinian negotiating team wants this too. So why, if this has been the understood paradigm for resolving this issue for the last 15 years, when it was first put forward by Clinton in 2000, why has it taken 15 years to negotiate this endgame? It's very simple. Because when the United States and Israel talk about a Palestinian state, and the Palestinian negotiating team talks about a Palestinian state, it's not at all like a Venn diagram. There's no overlap between these two conceptions. So what would the Palestinians get under this deal that was being put forward by Kerry? That Israel would annex all of its major settlement blocks. Between 80 and 90% of Israel's settlement population would stay in place, cutting the West Bank up into tiny, disconnected little fragments of land. Furthermore, all of the infrastructure of Israeli military occupation would stay right where it is today. The apartheid wall under this plan would stay. Israeli military bases and checkpoints and roadblocks and apartheid bypass roads, all of this would stay. There would be a long-term Israeli military presence in the Jordan Valley, cutting off the West Bank from Jordan. And if you want to talk about Jerusalem, Zaha showed that map of where the wall cuts through Jerusalem. Palestinians would have no sovereignty in Jerusalem. Their capital would be in a far suburb of Jerusalem called Abu Dis, which is behind the wall that cuts it off from Jerusalem. The U.S.-Israeli proposal was not for there to be any Palestinian state in the sense that you and I understand this word, because when the Palestinian negotiating team says that it wants a state, they mean it in the sense that 193 other countries in the world have sovereignties and powers. But none of the powers and sovereignties that we associate with statehood, right? Control over borders, control over airspace, control over water and natural resources, and so on, none of this would apply to this Palestinian entity. In fact, this Palestinian entity wouldn't even have control over its electromagnetic field. Now, I'm gonna confess something to you. When Netanyahu first started talking about that, I didn't know what that meant. So I looked it up, and it turns out that it relates to things like cell phones and radio airwaves. Palestinians won't even be able to control their cell phone network in this deal. This is the truncated entity that the United States and Israel are trying to impose on the Palestinians and why they rejected it, basically turning the West Bank into a second version of what the Gaza Strip is today, which is a blockaded and besieged entity that's subject to Israel's complete control and collective punishment. Is it any wonder why this didn't work? What this U.S.-Israeli plan most represents is not an end to Israel's apartheid policies toward the Palestinians, but the reverse. And it actually resembles exactly what South Africa attempted to do to get the international community off of its back in the 1970s and the 1980s, which was to create independent homelands for black South Africans known as Bantustans. The idea was to herd black South Africans into these tiny, disconnected little fragments of land that had no autonomy, no sovereignty, no power whatsoever, and declare that South Africa was no longer exercising apartheid and that black South Africans had their self-determination through these Bantustans. And guess what? South Africa actually found black South African leaders to run these Bantustans. How many countries recognized these Bantustans as states? One did. One did, it was South Africa. The international community was not fooled. And what the United States rejected as a fair resolution in South Africa, the United States this year tried to impose at the behest of Israel on the Palestinian people, which is why these negotiations failed. And I would say that for negotiations to succeed, Israel has to commit in advance to the dismantling of its apartheid policies toward the Palestinian people, because this is what the transition was about in South Africa. The ANC didn't negotiate about how to continue apartheid. They negotiated with the apartheid government only after the decision had been made to transition to a democracy and toward equality, not before. So, as a precondition for the next time that these negotiations take place, Israel must dismantle its apartheid regime, and then and only then can true negotiations for a just and lasting peace take place. Thank you.
All right, our last speaker is Phyllis Bennis, who I've known for many years, even around the time, the beginning of the peace process. She is a fellow at the Institute of Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and of the Amsterdam-based Transnational Institute. She's co-founder of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, and her books include Understanding the Israeli Conflict, a primer. I highly recommend it, not only for yourselves, but also as something to get others who want to understand the basic facts of the situation regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and also Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power, and Before and After, U.S. Foreign Policy and the War on Terror. Phyllis Bennis.
You know, the peace talks, there's a whole team of people, the Palestinians, the U.S., and the Israeli negotiators, who have all grown old with these peace talks. I remember the Madrid talks in 1991, and there was this excitement in the air, and everybody was kind of young, and you know, Bibi Netanyahu was the spokesman for the Israeli delegation. He wasn't a political operative at the time. He was an appointed spokesman. And there was a sense at that moment of, wow, this is a little bit different. It was really limited and really problematic in a whole host of ways I won't go into. But it, you know, it seemed like it was somehow the beginning of something new. And those same people are still running the show. You know, Saeb Erekat and you know, the whole gang of them. We've all grown old with this process. And guess what? It's a sham process that was aimed at a sham peace. I think it's important to keep in mind that the peace talks, as urgent as we've been hearing they are, you know, we hear all this stuff of the current situation is not sustainable. Well, actually, it is. It's not sustainable for the Palestinians. It is way sustainable for Israel. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But I think what's important when we look at the question of the U.S. policy, which is ultimately our responsibility as taxpayers, everybody in this room is responsible because $3.2 billion of our tax money every year goes directly to the Israeli military. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Send it off to the IDF. And for those of us who are U.S. citizens, because we elect these people. So it's not surprising that around the world, people look at the U.S. policy and say, you know what? We sort of think you're responsible. You know, remember what happens when Israel is bombing Gaza. Imagine Cass Lead, you all remember seeing it on television, the first of Israel's wars that was so dramatically broadcast in real time. And in those brief moments when the bombing stopped somewhere in Gaza, someone would look out her window in Gaza City or in Rafah, and where a bomb wasn't dropping off and it was safe to look out for a moment, and what would she see? She would see a U.S.-made, U.S.-paid-for F-16 dropping U.S.-made, U.S.-paid-for bombs, Apache helicopters, TOW missiles, tear gas canisters stamped made in Pennsylvania, and we wonder why people hold us responsible? It's because we are responsible. And the only ones of us who are not are those who fight against allowing it to continue, which goes to why we're all here. To figure out what these talks are about, why they're failing, whether it matters, and what to do about it. So what's important to understand, I think, is that as important as we hear these talks are, the peace talks are not now and have never been the fundamental core of U.S. policy towards Israel. It's also important to keep in mind the U.S. doesn't really have a policy towards Palestine and Palestinians. The U.S. really wouldn't mind if there was a one-state solution, a two-state solution, one state, two state, red state, blue state. That's not their concern. Their concern is maintaining Israel as a strategic partner. So what Israel says relative to the Palestinians, that's what goes. So what we're talking about is not a U.S. policy towards Israel-Palestine. We're talking about a U.S. policy towards Israel, which has both a strategic side and a political side. The strategic side is led by the Pentagon, the military-industrial complex, the White House and Congress. The political side is led by AIPAC and the rest of the Jewish and Christian components of the pro-Israel lobbies. But there is a policy towards Israel. That's what shapes it. So the talks are not primary. What is primary is money, the $3.2 billion a year that goes to the military, and the diplomatic and political and strategic protection under which the U.S. makes sure that Israeli officials, whether political or military leaders, are never held accountable at the United Nations or anywhere else, and the conditions under which Israel knows it can depend on its, quote, strategic ally, this new term. You know, this was just passed in Congress a couple weeks ago, that Israel is now officially our strategic ally. No definition of what it means. You know, you might think that maybe Britain is a strategic ally, you know. Maybe Canada, our biggest trading partner, is a sort of strategic ally. You know, maybe it's the European Union as a whole. Who knows? But Israel, really? That's our one strategic ally in the world? You know, it's a very interesting notion. But what we're seeing is that we're hearing only about the peace talks, and we're not hearing about this whole other side of the U.S. policy towards Israel. We hear about the U.S. as the honest broker. Now, here I've got to disagree with my old friend Josh. Josh said that you can't talk about an honest broker in this context. Well, I think you actually can. How many of you here have ever bought or sold a house? Let's see hands. Ooh, a lot of you. It's what happens when you're not speaking to a college campus audience, when you have adults in the room who have bought and sold houses. So when you buy or sell a house, you have a broker, right? And you assume the broker is honest. Most of them are honest, I guess. But you don't have only one broker for both sides. Each side gets their own broker, right? So if I buy a house, I have a broker whose goal is to keep that price as low as possible, right? But the other side, the sellers, have a broker whose job it is to jack up the price. So you have two brokers. Now, what we have with the U.S. is they're the only broker for both sides. The Palestinian Authority has made a decision in the context of which the Palestinian Authority was never authorized to engage in foreign affairs or negotiations with Israel at all. That was to be done only by the PLO. But it was the PA, the Palestinian Authority, who appointed a foreign minister and then appointed negotiators who just happened to be the same ones as before, but that's a different issue. And we hear constantly about President Mahmoud Abbas, which is his title as president of the Palestinian Authority, not as head of the PLO, in which his title is chairman. We should be hearing all the time about Mr. Chairman. We don't. We hear Mr. President. But that's a side point. That's not the main point. The main point is the Palestinians made a decision to put all their strategic diplomatic eggs in the U.S. basket. So the U.S. becomes their broker. Now, what does that mean? It means that they took the position that only the U.S. can deliver Israel, so we've got to rely on the U.S. Now, the first part of that is true. Only the U.S. could deliver Israel. But the U.S. has made it very, very abundantly clear that it has no intention of delivering Israel. So can really has nothing to do with it. So we have a serious problem where we have one broker for both sides in this sham peace talks. Then we have the question of U.S. pressure. You know, you remember the summer of 2010, second year of President Obama's term, and suddenly settlements are all over the news, and there's all this stuff about the U.S. is putting pressure on Israel. Oh my God, Obama is pressuring Netanyahu. Oh my God, they're throwing Israel under a bus. Well, there was no bus. Nobody threw anybody anywhere. And in fact, there really wasn't even pressure. What there was a series of requests, very polite requests. Please stop building settlements. Answer, no. Please stop building settlements, no. Please stop building just some of the settlements for just a little bit, just for a couple of months, just so we can say it's like a temporary freeze. Maybe, no. And then they stopped asking. Now, pressure would have looked something like this. Please stop building settlements. No. Okay, you're an independent country, you can do what you want, but you know that $3.2 billion that we're giving you this year as part of the $30 billion we're giving you? You can kiss that goodbye. And you know how we protect your people in the UN so that you're never held accountable when you commit war crimes? We're not doing that anymore. That's the beginning of what pressure looks like. Because really, that's not even pressure. That's just taking away the perks. That's starting on a more neutral territory. There is nothing neutral, there is nothing even about these talks. These talks are not a border dispute between Peru and Ecuador, where you have two sides that go to the International Court of Justice and say, help us sort out this border dispute. And both come as independent countries, they sit at the same table, and they work it out one way or the other. One's a little unhappy, one's a little more happy, whatever. That ain't here. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about one side, which is the 26th or 23rd, depending on whether you believe the CIA or the IMF, either the 26th or the 23rd wealthiest country in the world, by far the strongest, most powerful military in the entire Middle East, the only nuclear weapons arsenal in the Middle East, if you don't count the U.S. floating arsenals on its aircraft carriers, but we don't have to, on land, it's the only country in the Middle East that has its own nuclear weapons arsenal, and backed by the world's sole superpower. That's one side. And in the other corner, we have the Palestinians, stateless, landless, armyless, without the support of anyone, but they're sitting at the same table, so we'll call it even negotiations, and we'll remind the world that both sides need to make concessions. Both sides need to recognize they won't get everything they want. We can't make peace more than the two parties, as if these were two equal parties instead of the occupying power and the occupied population. That's the challenge that we have today. That's what the Kerry talks were all about. And I would say one thing that's particularly dangerous, we haven't talked much about the regional context in which this all occurs. But one of the big reasons for the new sudden attention to the peace talks that had been allowed to kind of founder for a while is precisely because the U.S. ain't doing so good in the rest of the region. The U.S. isn't so popular in the region right now. The U.S. hasn't had such a good creative strategic approach to the Arab Spring, to the crisis of after its intervention that was so disastrous in Libya, to the crisis that is devastating a population in Syria. The U.S. doesn't have a good answer for any of this. So one of the things that's part of this is to divert attention to the one area where maybe we can do something, which, ironically enough, they could, but they've chosen not to, because to do so would mean putting the pressure on Israel. And unfortunately, somehow in that Washington bubble that's called the White House, they never got the memo that said the discourse has changed, and it is no longer political suicide to criticize Israel. They didn't get the memo. So they're acting as if this is still a moment when to say anything critical of Israel is somehow to risk your political career. Pretty soon, we're going to be at the point where it's going to be political suicide not to criticize Israel. But we're not there yet. We're not there yet. And that's why we have to work very hard. Josh went through the terms of what this agreement would have looked like, this framework. And remember, this is only a framework. Both sides were going to be allowed to sign on to it with reservations, meaning they could sign on to it, checking off every one, every paragraph as a reservation, agreeing to nothing but say, hey, we signed it. You know, that's number one. Number two, it was only a framework for future peace talks of unknown duration under unknown provenance. A couple of the points that Josh raised I think are particularly important. The capital would be outside of Jerusalem. We all are betting on Abu Dis which is a dusty little town at the end of the Silk Road. It's somehow ironic. The Silk Road now dead ends at the wall. Where? In Abu Dis. I mean, it's a classic place. The wall will become the new border. And as you all know, if you put the map of the wall over a map of the aquifers of the West Bank, what you see is that the wall was very, very, very carefully constructed so that every major water resource is on the Israeli side of the wall. What a coincidence. Who knew that was going to happen? You know, we are talking about permanent occupation, because occupation is defined as control. And when an outside country controls your borders, your airspace, your water, your coastal waters, and your, what is it called again, the cell phone thing? The electromagnetic thing. That means you're not independent. That means you're still occupied. It's a different form of occupation. Like Gaza, it's a siege rather than settler colonialism. There are many forms of occupation. They are all still occupation. They all need to be ended. There was an interesting quote from Samantha Power a day or so ago. You remember our great UN ambassador. Went, now. She said, she was talking on C-SPAN, and she said on the Palestinian question, I would underscore that we will oppose Palestinian attempts at upgrades in status anywhere. This is talking about Palestinian right to join UN agencies. We are in very close touch now. We have a monthly meeting with the Israelis where we look out at the sea of international organizations and UN entities, including treaty bodies and treaties and so forth, and coordinate with them, the Israelis, and also try to understand whether they're prioritizing in particular ways on the lines of what you're suggesting, meaning we'll follow your lead on which ones to prioritize. And then she talks about the International Criminal Court, saying that's, of course, something we have been absolutely adamant about. Secretary Kerry has made it very, very clear to the Palestinians, as has the president, I mean, this is something that really poses a profound threat to Israel. It is not a unilateral action that will be anything other than devastating to the peace process, which is, again, where all of our efforts should now be placed. And then she says, talking about the U.S. legislation that requires the U.S. to stop funding any U.N. agency that welcomes Palestine as a full member, she says, the spirit behind the legislation is to deter Palestinian action. That is what we do all the time, and that is what we will continue to do. I mean, this is their position in the United Nations. One of the phrases I think we need to keep in mind that is central to the U.S. policy here is the very simple phrase, everyone knows. Everyone knows that all of the major settlement blocks will be Israeli at the end of the day. So why are we allowing the settlement expansion to be an issue? Everyone knows they're going to be part of the Israeli territory when we have our two-state solution. Okay. Everyone knows that? The Palestinians who used to live there, who still hold the keys to their houses on that land, do they know that? Does international law know that? That doesn't apparently matter. Everyone knows, so we don't have to talk about it. So this is one of the huge challenges that we have, to say that the entire basis of this sham peace process has nothing to do with peace. Because unlike the US government of the moment and most of its predecessors, we take very seriously the definition of peace put forward by Dr. Martin Luther King, who said that peace is not just the absence of war and violence, peace is the presence of justice. Now, what in this so-called framework even hints at justice? What it hints at is legitimation of a settler colonial project. We heard yesterday, we heard recently about Rhodesia and Cecil Rhodes. Where's Max? Max, was that you who said something about Cecil Rhodes? Yes. Well, one of the other things about Cecil Rhodes that's important to recognize is that he was a great hero of the great hero of modern Zionism. Who's the great hero of modern Zionism? Theodore Herzl, the guy who invented it, right? He's the one who wrote the book, The Jewish State, who, among other things, said it doesn't have to be in Palestine because this really isn't about reclaiming biblical land. This isn't about the biblical Zionism. So we'll look at Uganda, we'll look at Argentina, we'll look at anywhere in the world to build this Jewish state because this is really not about religion. Oh, okay, till it was. But that's not the point. My point was that same Theodore Herzl, who I grew up thinking was a great hero, he wrote a letter. He wrote a lot of letters that are in his diaries. But one of the letters he wrote was to Cecil Rhodes, the great British colonialist who captured half of southern Africa and called it under his own name and named it Rhodesia. And what he said in his letter to Cecil Rhodes, he said, "I know that your interest is Africa, and mine is a little sliver of Arabia." That's what he called Palestine. "Your interest is Englishmen, mine is Jews. But both of these are colonial projects. And so you should join me in supporting this colonial project because both of us are involved in bringing the light to these benighted populations." Now, anyone want to really wonder what the founder of modern Zionism had in mind when he writes a letter like that to the leading British colonialist who, for at least two generations I'm aware of, has been excoriated for being the leading British colonialist? That's what this is about. This is about maintaining colonialism and making it permanent. And finally, when we talk with members of the administration, and I've got a couple of great stories I don't have time for now, but when you talk with them, they will say that the goal of these talks is to end the conflict and end the claims. They don't say this is to end the occupation, to end apartheid, to end injustice. They say this is to end the conflict, meaning stop fighting back, and to end the claims, meaning that once we have an agreement, anyone who even hints that I still have rights that are not being granted, that are not being recognized, whether it's the right to return for refugees, the right to live with equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel, or the right to not live under occupation for those living in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. Whatever the rights are that are still not being recognized, that those rights will no longer be recognized. And that the U.S., maybe in response to passing, negotiating, if we're lucky, a real resolution to the conflict with Iran, and there is a, imagine a comprehensive deal between the U.S. and Iran, Israel will be furious and the U.S. will want to mollify the Israeli government. What's likely to happen? That gift to Israel will be paid in Palestinian rights. Just what President Bush did with Prime Minister Sharon in 1994 in a letter when Bush gave away the right of return and the Israeli right to claim permanently the giant settlement blocks as if they were his rights to give away. That's the danger of these talks, these sham talks, these Einstein talks, because yes, this is crazy, to do the same thing over and over again, think you're going to get a different result, and to think you're going to get justice. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Phyllis. We spoke about the United States, we spoke about Israel, but what about the Palestinian Authority? What's their interest in participating in these talks, which Phyllis, you described as sham talks, and Josh, you said were leading basically to an apartheid situation. What is their interest in these talks? And also, given that in the last couple days, President Abbas has said, since he believes the situation be failing, particularly because Israel did not make this final, at least the stated reason he gave, the final prisoner release, he said he is going automatically to the United Nations to apply for full membership. So what's the interest of the Palestinian leadership, Palestinian Authority, in maintaining this situation, and what does it appear that they're going to be doing now, now that they appear to fail? And also, someone threw in, just to continue on the same question, I hope you guys answer, why not reconstitute the PLO? Couldn't they play a role? Because you mentioned this earlier. But go ahead, you guys answer.
The question of the PA versus the PLO is a very complicated issue, but it's one that belongs squarely to the Palestinian people. I mean, we can sit here and say, well, I wish that the PLO was the ANC and whatever, but that's not for supporters, that is for the Palestinian people to determine for themselves. I did want to just say one other thing, just commenting on one point that Zaha raised that I think is really important about this equation of the Palestinian decision to join UN agencies with Israeli violations in terms of settlement construction. One of the things that we're seeing just today, last night and today, in response to the Israeli decision not to release the last group of prisoners, that was the deal. That was the quid pro quo. Israel and the Palestinians each made a promise to the U.S. We'll stay at the talks for these 9.5 months if, and for the Palestinians it was, if Israel releases the 104 104 Palestinian prisoners in the four groups. And for the Israelis, it was if the Palestinians don't join the International Criminal Court, which on the one hand is like a ridiculous equation, but both stuck to it until this last group of prisoners, Israel announced that they were not going to release them. And it was at that point that the Palestinians went and signed on to 15 treaties and treaty bodies. But very importantly, reflecting what Zaha said about reasons why, they did not try to join any UN agencies, and they did not try to join the ICC, the International Criminal Court. They joined only treaty bodies that actually restrict the PA itself, appropriately, to maintaining international standards of human rights. So they signed on to the treaties involving the rights of women, the rights of children, the rights of disabled people, the Fourth Geneva Conventions, etc., not any that they could use against Israel. And yet, that is still being tossed around as an accusation that somehow this is why the talks foundered.
I think, from my reading of the Palestine Papers, which is an incredibly important set of leaked documents from within the Palestinian negotiating team, that the negotiating team was actually quite optimistic about Obama and his presidency in 2009, and I quote, the negotiating team from the Palestine Papers in the book, they were actually literally sitting around and reading George Mitchell's book and how he brokered peace in Northern Ireland. And the lesson learned from Mitchell's book was that we might finally get the fair shake out of Washington, D.C. that we've never received before if Mitchell does the same thing with us. So I think they really did have a lot of hope in the Obama presidency, but they were quickly disillusioned, and I document some very acrimonious meetings held between Mitchell and Saeb Erekat in September of 2009 after the Palestinians had realized that it was indeed business as usual with the Obama administration and they weren't going to get a fair shake. I also quote Saeb Erekat in the book as telling James Jones at the beginning of Obama's administration, he said, look, I've been doing this for 17 years, and this is the last time I'm doing it. That was in 2009. He did it again in 2010. And as far as I know, he's still doing it today, even though I think he's now resigned four or five times. Has it been? He's back now. Okay. I agree with Zaha that, Palestinians are really in an untenable lose-lose situation, right? They have one of two options. Don't go to the negotiating table, in which case they're blamed for being the rejectionists, or go to the negotiating table and being faced with this farcical prospect of signing on to the perpetuation of apartheid. So it's really a lose-lose situation. You can't take the power dynamics out of the situation. And just one more quote from the book, from WikiLeaks this time around, one of the Israeli generals told a U.S. counterpart, pass on this message to the Palestinian Authority. If you proceed with going to the ICC, then we are going to turn the West Bank into a second Gaza. This was like right after Cass led. So these are very real threats that have real repercussions and that the Palestinians know Israel will do.
Okay, another series of questions that came in were about if this is a sham peace process, what is the interest of the U.S.? And also, why does it appear, since this is the analysis that you were giving, that the U.S. is so subservient to Israel's agenda? Why are Obama and Kerry going along with Israel's apartheid policies? There was a great number of questions here. Are the Democrats or Republicans more controlled by the pro-Israel lobby? What explains the continuation of this process on the terms that you guys described?
It's a very good question, set of questions. It's the fundamental one. I think it's important not to see this as a situation in which the U.S. is controlled by the Israelis. That's not the case. Israel remains the junior partner in this. The key thing to keep in mind is that there is a two-part relationship that a couple of us referred to. On the one hand, you have a political relationship that has been built up for many, many decades, but particularly since 1967 in the midst of the Cold War, when you have a strategic value, Israel as a junior partner, Israel as a cat's paw around the world of U.S. interests, particularly militarily, somewhat economically in other ways, but especially militarily. And you saw that not only in the region, but in the Cold War, in places as far afield as Angola and El Salvador and Nicaragua and Mozambique, South Africa, Guatemala, all of these hot wars that popped up during the Cold War, Israel acted in the interests of the United States. So that strategic interest was always fundamental. In that context, the existing influence of the pro-Israel lobbies in the early days, particularly the Jewish lobby, the Christian lobbies were later in the game, but the Jewish lobbies, AIPAC in particular, that had been around for a long time but never had that much influence, suddenly had a lot of influence because now they matched the trajectory of where the strategic policymakers wanted to go. So in that context, they grew in strength and power. And when you have the end of the Cold War, suddenly the strategic value of Israel as a great asset is now kind of up for grabs. It's not so clear what role it's going to play. That's when the role of the lobbies keeps the pressure on and keeps that political role, particularly its role in Congress with money, et cetera, keeps it important. Until the end of the post-Cold War period, you suddenly have the new era of the global war on terror. And once again, Israel is this incredibly important strategic partner. So throughout that, it's the intersection of the role of the lobbies, the political role of the lobbies, and the strategic value of Israel as determined by military corporations, military manufacturers, the Pentagon itself, and the White House and Congress, who recognize it as a very, very tight ally for a lot of nefarious deeds around the world that the U.S. is doing, some of which it doesn't want to be blamed for, and it will be perfectly willing to blame Israel. So it's a convenient ally in many situations. So it's in that context that you see the importance of keeping Israel happy. So the U.S. goes to the talks because they can't afford to appear to be abandoning a situation which defenders of Israel call unsustainable, despite the fact that it is fundamentally very sustainable for Israel. If you took away the levels of violence today, if there was nobody shooting a gun, nobody throwing a stone, no instance of violence anywhere in all of historic Palestine, what would it look like? For Israelis, it would be great. You know, they're the 23rd or 26th wealthiest country in the world. Their passport is good everywhere. They can go wherever they want, do what they want. They've got whatever they want. For Palestinians, they would still be living under military occupation, even if the violence ended today. So this claim that this is all about stopping the violence, no, it isn't. Stopping the violence is an important component, but it's not justice. That's what we learned from Dr. King.
That was Phyllis Bennis, author of Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict and fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. We also heard Josh Rubner, author of Shattered Hopes, Obama's Failure to Broker Israeli-Palestinian Peace. They spoke on a panel at the Friends of Sabil conference, which was held in Portland in April. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 10 a.m. Coming up, it's Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with your host, Chris Andre, followed at 10:15 by Flashpoints. And at 11, it's the incomparable Radio Zine with the focus on genetically modified food. Keep it locked right here at your community radio, KBOO Portland.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, June 27th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. Just a few headlines, because we've got a huge story today to talk about. The oil by rail routes published for the first time. You can find it all at the Smog blog, and Steve Horn is going to be joining us today to talk a bit more about the trains, and you would expect that